My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagerits, and we are back with the Western Bubble Podcast. Today, we're talking about the reality of a post-neoliberal order. Balder, that's a heavy intro to an episode. What does it even mean?
Hi Dario, it's actually about really practical things, but we have been in this podcast and other authors and speakers for a very long time, for the past 25 years, have been saying, look, the neoliberal world order is in trouble ever since 9/11. Things are quickly changing in a way that the neoliberal order can't control, right? Or everything that was built up in the second half of 20th century is slowly being chiseled away at. And now in 2025, you actually see the effects of the disappearance of this order. So it's no longer a theoretical issue, like a big philosophical conversation about, is there going to be a future without neoliberalism? No, if you look around the news today, October 31st, 2025, you see signs of the absence of a neoliberal order everywhere. And the problem, of course, is that the neoliberal order has not been replaced by anything else. It's moving towards anarchy. There is no new order, there's no new vision, no new ideology. And the result of that is that we're now living in an incredibly anarchical world, and it's only going to get worse from here, with a lot of violence and human suffering as a result.
I do want to stress what you just said. It's that it has not been replaced yet. Because, I mean, if you listen to this podcast, we're critics of the neoliberal order. I mean, we take jabs at it at every opportunity because there's many flaws within that system. However, we're also on record saying that one of the worst things that can happen is kind of revolution, is anarchy, because that's usually when even worse things come out of it. And I think we are currently living in a time where we are clearly observing them, whether it is about tariffs, whether it's about blowing up boats without consequences, whether it's about humanitarian catastrophes all over the world and the world not really caring any longer because the mechanisms to deal with them are gone. But those are just one of the few topics we'll talk about today.
Yeah, it's basically a matter of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, right? So we are not critics, at least I don't believe we are, of some of the fundamentals of Western liberal society. I mean, there are a lot of good things in Western liberal society. Not that it's the only answer to the world's problems. There are alternatives that could replace it, should replace it maybe, but there are a lot of good things that at the foundation of liberal democracy should be treasured. The problem with neoliberalism is that it is a liberal democracy going into hyperdrive, going crazy, basically no longer understanding the foundations of what liberal democracy is trying to do and just saying, hey, all we need to do is manage the economy and everything's going to be fine. And that order, that is sort of the last hurrah of liberal democracy, is now collapsing. And if we could take a time machine and go back to the 1980s or 1990s and say to the people then, please, please take everything that is good about your model, about your vision, and leave everything that's bad behind and build a 21st century on the good stuff, then we would probably have a very different 21st century. However, they did the opposite. They left all the good stuff behind and they went with the bad stuff. And now there's a result of an order that is anarchical, without vision, without point, and with a lot of unnecessary violence and human suffering.
Because we're no longer living in a world that is based on multilateralism, but based on basically multipolarity, right? Is that there's a few different poles of strength, and they are competing with each other, almost like in hardcore realism. And anything that came out of that multilateral world is slowly being, I wouldn't even say taken apart, I would just say ignored. Because I don't see anyone dismantling the United Nations. I don't see anyone dismantling the World Health Organization, right? Maybe there's defunding from certain actors, but so those organizations still exist, but I think they're just being ignored. There's no more importance for them in this world.
Yeah, their death will be a slow, painful one based on their irrelevance. It will not. It's not worth fighting. No one is fighting the UN. The UN is not an enemy. In fact, in some cases here and there, it can still have some use. No, the problem is that whereas liberal democracy in the 20th century tried to build up this Western bubble system around the world where everyone was going to be liberal and democratic, which was a mistaken approach, despite the good things of liberal democracy, was obviously never going to properly work. Those transnational institutions only made sense if we were going with this liberal and then neoliberal world order. And the moment that neoliberal world order has shown to be incredibly destructive because they forgot about the foundations of what makes liberal democracy good, is the moment that forces basically start ignoring it. The UN was important in the 1990s only because it had the backing of large, powerful societies in Europe and North America and Japan that wanted it to succeed. Now nobody wants it to succeed because nobody is espousing this vision anymore. Nobody has a vision, and then these institutions become completely pointless. And it's kind of painful to see how organizations such as the UN desperately try to keep themselves relevant, by becoming like a watchdog of moral values and, okay, which moral values based on whom, and assessed by whom, etc. And it's painful to see how the World Trade Organization is completely irrelevant, has completely disappeared. All of that is the result of a failed project that is no longer a theoretical discussion. It is a real practical issue happening today. The project has failed. We see the results, the practical outcome, as we speak. In some ways, it's a bit similar to climate change, right? In the 1970s, 1980s, people thought of climate change as still something abstract, something that, yeah, scientists are saying that we're in trouble, but we don't really feel it, maybe in somewhere in the 21st century. Well, now here we are. You can see the effects of climate change everywhere. And just like with the neoliberal world order, it's kind of too late to really salvage the situation.
One of the organizations that it has just become too easy to ignore is the World Trade Organization. And that leads us to one of the other aspects or one of the other examples where we can see the neoliberal world order. I think collapsing is maybe too strong of a word because I'm not sure whether it's happening that quickly, but just on the demise. And that would be tariffs, where we now live in the world where you can just slash each other, right? Countries slash each other with tariffs. And whereas 10, 15 years ago, the World Trade Organization would have had a serious word to say there. I don't know, are they still making statements? At least I have not read a single statement by them because either they are still making statements and the media is not picking it up because nobody cares, or they're no longer even making statements because why would you? There's no point.
I'm sorry to bring up a different topic, Dario, but this reminds me a little bit of how completely absent Fatah and the PLO have been in the whole Gaza conflict over the past 2 years, right? The world, you know, also, do they make statements? Don't they make statements? Who cares? What does it matter? No, that's kind of the same with the World Trade Organization. So there are two things to observe here. The World Trade Organization still exists, but nobody cares about it. It is just there because it's there, right? Its people are employed by the World Trade Organization. They still get funding. And that funding will slowly disappear. There will always be some World Trade Organization left. There might not always be a UN left, but there will always be something called a World Trade Organization. But it no longer has much practical impact from a bigger picture perspective. That is not to say that there aren't like technical things that the World Trade Organization still does that we don't see that are not in the news, but, you know, to keep relations smooth. But the irrelevance, political irrelevance, the geopolitical irrelevance of the World Trade Organization is obvious for everyone to see. And the second thing about it is that there is no driver behind it. Just like what I just said with respect to the UN, nobody really supports the World Trade Organization anymore. You know, this is a foundational thing, right? Nobody is trying to protect it. Nobody is trying to say, can we please go back to this? China, who are making the case that they are the reasonable actors on the world stage and that they want to just have a fair playing field with everyone, that's their political discourse, Even they have kind of given up on the WTO and are no longer using it as a vehicle for their own agenda. And so essentially it's one of those multilateral organizations that is only relevant if it has large states, geopolitical players backing it. And the moment nobody backs it, then it just goes into an anonymous state where nobody even remembers that it exists.
So let's be real here for a second. So what are the countries that are undermining, or which is the country that's most responsible for undermining the World Trade Organization and being responsible for a lot of the terrorists out there? It's obviously the United States. And just to throw in some facts, because sometimes, we of course know that the United States create a lot of tariffs, particularly the Trump administration, of course. But it does make sense to once in a while look at numbers just to show how big the changes are. So from January to April to April 2025, the average applied U.S. tariff rate rose from 2.5 to an estimated 27%. That's at the highest level in over a century, right? And despite low level negotiations, right, mostly bilateral, by the way, never multilateral, it kind of dropped to maybe 18%, 17.9% in September of 2025. And which I think is very interesting is that the kind of money the United States government makes based off these tariffs, right? So the revenue they create went from $10 billion per month in 2024 to $30 billion per month in 2025, which that's already quite a big gap. And if you look at then the countries that usually uphold multilateral organizations, right? So the West, that are usually the ones fighting for them or politicizing them, that's not really possible this time, because it is one of their own who's basically cutting the WTO's legs off, right? So usually you would hear Germany making a big statement and even appealing to the World Trade Organization and the UK as well, but it's the United States doing that. If we start an official complaint against Trump, then he's going to hit us with more tariffs and he's going to bully us even stronger. So let's just be quiet. And not say anything.
And this goes back to a conversation that we've had in the past, that I wish that Europe, not so much because I care about the WTO, but I wish that Europe would still have made a stand. But they don't. They don't want this fight with Trump. They want to manage the situation rather than tell the world, we are still, the United States is gone, but we as Europe still believe in fair trade with everyone, as free as possible within certain limits. And even though with the United States it's going to be hard for you to do business, you can absolutely do business with us. In order to send that message out, they should have stood up to the United States, and they didn't. And so, of course, that then leads to the further demise of the WTO, obviously, but that is not the biggest concern here. The biggest concern is that we're all in a race to the bottom. And if then the topic of today is the collapse of the neoliberal world order and the effects of a post-neoliberal world order, then this is probably the most fundamental thing. Because remember, neoliberalism is all about free trade, economic goods and services moving between countries, creating efficiency gains, creating higher productivity, increasing economic growth, and thereby lifting, at least theoretically, there are lots of practical problems, but theoretically, lifting the world up to a new level of human well-being. That is at least the measure. So tariffs and the end of free trade is probably the most brutal sign of the end of the neoliberal world order. You cannot have a neoliberal world order where this happens, where it's a wild west of just using tariffs left, right, and center, and there's no sheriff in town protecting anyone against that kind of bullying.
Now that we're talking about that one bully out there, the United States, is not only bullying countries and individuals with tariffs, but also by threatening to blow them up or even blowing them up. And one of the examples here is that the United States military began executing airstrikes on vessels, is a big word, on boats, right? On small little speedboats with a few people in there in the Caribbean Sea in September 2025, right? Largely connected to Venezuela, so in and around Venezuela, and framed by the Trump administration as a fight against drug trafficking. And in October, The Trump administration expanded these strikes to the Eastern Pacific Ocean. And as of 2 days ago, right, so we are recording this on the 31st of October. Happy Halloween to people who are interested in that. There have been at least 61 people killed from 15 vessels struck in the last 2 months, right? And that is, I mean, just imagine 5 years ago Trump was in office. Just imagine 10 years ago that let's say Iran had done that to I don't know to little boats off of its coast, or not even off of its coast, right? So let's say to little boats in the Indian Ocean. Iran had suddenly struck them, claiming that they were smuggling weapons to, let's say, Israel. I just imagined the outcry by the West. But now that the United States is doing it, I haven't heard the other Western countries making any statements. Maybe they've done them, right? Like somewhere slow and try to bury them under some other topics. But where's the outcry?
Yeah, and this goes back to what we just said before. Let's not kid ourselves, even though arguably the foundations of liberalism come from Europe, the practical application of a neoliberal world order, or even a liberal world order in the 20th century, comes from the United States. The moment that the United States no longer follows the rules, there's no other sheriff in town. There's no one else to actually pick it up. Yes, European countries might frown at it and might feel uncomfortable with it, but tough luck, they're not powerful enough to do anything about it, right? So the reason why we talk about the United States is that any order based on the past 100 years needs the United States to continue it. And the US has now decided we're no longer part of this. We're just gonna live in an anarchical world. Who's gonna hurt us? No one, because we're still the most powerful, we're still the strongest, and we are gonna be able to get away with it, at least in the short term, right? And so if you then look at the boat strikes, 61 people being killed, okay, you can have a conversation about the immoral nature of this. Let's face it, let's say that each of these boats was actually carrying drugs, was actually narco trafficking. These are 18-year-old men, 20-year-old men that are being sent by drug lords across the ocean to sell weapons. Do they deserve the death penalty without any trial? I mean, you can talk about, you know, the deep immorality of just killing people on a boat, even if they have drugs. Okay, they're criminal, but being a criminal doesn't mean that you automatically deserve death. It certainly doesn't mean that you deserve death without a trial, right? I mean, I would be opposed to the death penalty anywhere, anytime. But even if you believe in the death penalty, at least give them a chance to defend themselves. Who knows? And this is based on the idea that they were all narco traffickers, whereas in reality, it's very likely that some of them were immigrant, you know, immigrants, refugees, whatever, they or just people doing other stuff. We have no
Fishermen.
fishermen. We have no way of verifying this and just saying, "Hey, trust the United States government to know what they're doing." Well, no, thank you very much. I will not trust them to know what they're doing. But from the perspective of this episode, again, this is of course the end of any order. The point of order, even if it's led by one or two or three major powers, is that there are certain rules in place about what you can and cannot do. And this is exactly why the United States made such a mess out of, for example, the war on terror, because they started breaking their own rules. They started breaking the rules that they had set up before, and they started saying, well, it doesn't apply to us because we have been the victims of 9/11 and now we can do whatever we like. We're going to invade Iraq because we're going to overthrow Saddam Hussein, etc., etc. They started breaking the rules, and now they've set a precedent for the whole world. And it's escalating further. And without those large powers abiding by those rules, there is simply anarchy. There is no order in place. Keep in mind that the point of an order for a global power is not that to be able to basically do whatever you like. It's the opposite, to say we are limiting our own reach, we are limiting our own ability to commit certain acts, even though practically we could do it, but we don't do it. And in exchange, we expect everyone to follow our leadership. We expect everyone to follow our benign authoritarianism, if you like, right? That was kind of the deal that the United States made with the world. But of course, that no longer works the moment you don't have any limitations on your own behavior. And that's what we're seeing with the United States right now.
And it's really scary. And again, I think the scariest part is that nobody is speaking up about it. That is, okay, I'm not expecting the Chinese government to ridicule the United States over this, just because it's not very like them, right, to kind of to get into trouble about that. Not even to trouble, but to kind of start trouble over this. But I'm right, because it's so hypocritical that particularly the countries, and I'm mostly talking about my own country here, but other Western countries that are usually so good at wagging their finger at other countries, right? Something that we've criticized for the last 3 years, that there's constant, like a constant wagging of the finger. Oh, why did you do this? Why did you do this? You need to respect international law. That there's nothing from them, right? It to me, it's shocking and it's embarrassing, and yeah, I wish it was different. I don't know. Am I wishing back for the good old Western bubble days where I could just get upset about the German government wagging their finger about this?
Now, well, in some ways, this is the complexity of the world, right? We don't like Western hypocrisy and Western arrogance, believing that they are at the top of the hill of moral virtue, right? That they can decide on who's right or who's wrong. But at least, at a very minimum, if you have that approach, you have to hold yourself to certain standards. And even though the hypocrisy and also kind of the destructive nature of a lot of policies over the past 60, 70, 80 years, and arguably hundreds of years of the West has been often horrifying to see, at least they had to look in the mirror and they had to still pretend to be good in their behavior, right? Now that pretense is completely gone. Nobody needs to pretend to be good anymore. And that is even worse, right? So the first situation wasn't great. There was hypocrisy, there was delusion, there was the bubble. We wanted to puncture through the bubble, but puncturing through the bubble doesn't mean completely getting rid of any sense of moral or international values or order, right? There has to be an alternative. There has to be a replacement of that bubble, and there's no replacement. China is a really interesting case because you mentioned it briefly, and I would think that maybe 10 years ago, China might have spoken up more clearly, but right now it seems that Beijing has recognized, and probably reasonably so, that they are not capable of providing a very clear alternative. And so, if they are not, so 10 years ago, they thought that they could replace the West. And now they're seeing that they're not powerful. They're seeing that the West is disappearing, but they can't replace it because they're just not powerful enough. And then they're not going to fight these fights about the, Venezuelan boats. It's not their problem. They've got other issues to deal with. So it's basically what you're observing of China being relatively silent about it is a sign that China admits its own limits in terms of geopolitical power.
I mean, we have to be careful because neither of us are China experts. But Richard, just to add to what you just said, I mean, 10 years ago, China also had a lot more fun poking holes into the Western bubble, right? Kind of pointing out Western hypocrisy whenever they could. And that's something, right? It's not hypocritical behavior if you're unapologetic about what you're doing, right? I mean, there's no one is even trying to hide it. I mean, they're just saying, nope, these are narco terrorists, so we're going to kill them because they're narco terrorists. Which, and then again, goes back to our good friend Barack Obama, who kind of who helped us a lot with first of all, like using drones left, right, and center everywhere in the world, and also having an easy time declaring someone as terrorist and then acting based on that.
And absolutely, no, and it's very clear, and it creates more of a void, this kind of reality that we're observing right now. And another thing, Dario, that you lamented, kind of like it's horrible to see, and I wish that someone would speak up. I'm sorry to belabor this point, but this goes a little bit back to that whole conversation about standing up to trade tariffs, right? This is exactly why I was so against Europe saying, oh, you know what, we're gonna let the US get away with it, we're gonna give Trump a victory. I wish that Europe fights the fight fought that fight and actually tells the world we're the good guys. We're no longer believing in the Western bubble. We're no longer part of this Western arrogance. We completely understand that things have gone wrong in the past. We understand that we still have a lot of repairing to do when it comes to neocolonialism, when it comes to wars that we were part of and that destroyed the lives of millions around the world. We understand all of that. However, we are now the reasonable center in the world, and you can count on us to behave rationally, but also morally. We will not go along with the bully in the White House. We will be a safe haven for you to come to deal with us and have a fair relationship. That's what Europe needs to do if it wants to have a significant position in the future. But it seems that leadership is so obsessed with not ruffling anyone's feathers, especially of the big orange man in the White House, that they just cannot see any further than 2, 3, 4 years ahead.
I think my... Because when did we record this episode? I think it was before the summer, right? Or during the summer.
I think July, probably.
Yeah. Maybe already June. Well, I mean, the tariffs did come into place. Well, we'll figure it out. Because my view of the Trump administration also has significantly changed since then, right? Where both of us, I remember, were a little bit surprised to how extreme and how quickly things changed within the Trump administration. And I must say that, particularly after summer and having a bit of time, I do see a lot of, and this is me being German and not saying these things lightly, I do see a lot of similarities to Germany in the 1930s and early, well, yeah, mostly 1930s. And that's why I think I have, in the past few weeks, shifted a bit more over to your side, where I think it's dangerous to follow an appeasement appeasement politics, because we have seen in history before that it doesn't work, right? That you need to, you definitely need to call this out and do something about it. And so, in that sense, I think I'm gonna look it up after this episode to figure out when we recorded this when we had that disagreement, because I would say that since then my opinion has changed. Right, I'm not fully with you. Because I still have these concerns about what are you going to do, right? If you go for a full-on confrontation with the United States, that's incredibly costly, right? You need, and as of now, I'm not sure how much popular support there is for that. But I agree with what we have said over the last 3 years, that this is now time for leadership. And that leadership sometimes also means that, yeah, things are not going to be comfortable for now, we're not going to rely on continuous economic growth of 2% and keeping inflation under 2%. Right. So I'm still a little bit torn between, I think I am with you, but I am more concerned about how would we execute that.
Well, revising one's past positions is the sign of a sophisticated mind, right? I mean, as John Maynard Keynes said, when facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? It's of course, as time goes by, we all get more information about reality. It's without information, it's informed speculation sometimes, but not much more than that. I obviously don't think that Europe can or should start a war. I mean, if we go back to the analogy of 1930s, the problem with France and the UK and what really surprised Hitler was that they didn't stop Germany with the Rhineland occupation. At that moment, Britain and France should have said, either you withdraw now or we declare war. And they did, and the fact that they didn't do that, as we know now, Hitler couldn't believe his eyes. He said, how do I get down? And then all the other steps, Sudetenland, Anschluss, and then eventually Poland, were kind of almost automatic, right? Now, in the case of the 2025, of course, Europe cannot militarily threaten and should not want to militarily threaten the United States. I mean, the United States is way too powerful militarily. It doesn't make any sense. Unlike, by the way, France and Britain, who were at the time more powerful than Germany militarily. The issue is not, there are limits to what you can do when you are concerned about the by far strongest power in the world. But what you at the very minimum as Europe can do is say, we are not you. So even though we can't stop you, at least certainly not militarily, and we don't want to, and we would very much like to have an open dialogue, and we want to keep on communication going, there are certain red lines that we will not cross. And the advantage for Europe with that would be that Europe becomes this safe haven for other countries to say, hey, we can become part of this movement. We can follow your indirect leadership, not the leadership of the United States in the 1990s, but kind of an indirect leadership of saying, we have still a certain set of principles that we will defend. And yeah, the price that you will pay is difficult conversations in the Oval Office and tariffs, at least in the short term. But it's also very likely that in the long run, Donald Trump and his surroundings will retreat if the cost becomes too high, because they don't have a very clear vision or plan of what the next 50 years need to look like either. So if it is too costly in the short term, then at some point they will withdraw. You can see that now with the Asia tour as well, Trump basically reducing a lot of the tariffs they've imposed. And so, you know, that would be kind of the analogy, right? I don't want anyone to walk away from this episode believing that I think Europe can fight a military fight against the United States. That would be insane.
No, but the first steps would, of course, be economic steps, right? Or even saying something, right? And maybe also signaling to the population within the US that, hey, you're not alone.
Yeah, and exactly, we've got your back. And simply not accepting tariffs, not saying, okay, we'll accept that you put 10% tariffs on. No, if you put tariffs on us, we will retaliate. And it will hurt you and it will hurt us. Let's see, let's play chicken. Let's see who's the first one to budge. And if the United States doesn't give in, well, we can do business with China. We can do business with India. You don't like that, do you, the United States? So there's plenty that Europe could do if they had some backbone. It's just that the current crop of European leaders don't seem to have any interest in positioning Europe as that kind of beacon of reason. Instead, we're letting Trump get away with it. And as you said, it's a form of appeasement.
Moving on to the last kind of example and topic of this episode, right? Again, still within, we are witnessing the demise of the neoliberal order. And right, so kind of talking about the biggest question of for any international relations student of the will of the late 20th century and of the early 21st century, and that's the responsibility to protect. And I know that we've had a very difficult conversation on this podcast about this topic, because it's a very difficult and fine line. And again, for the second time in this episode, I find myself wishing back the good old days from just a few years ago, where at least there would be a conversation within the West about what do we do with Sudan, right? So to give some context about what's happening in Sudan right now, Sudan has been in, I don't know the how manyth civil war for the past few decades. But since April 2023, in a particularly bad one between the current government and the army, and a powerful paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, right? And they have, right, they're kind of struggling for power within Sudan. This has led to the usual suspects, famine, the claims of genocide, right? I mean, 150,000 people have died in this conflict over the last few years. 12 million people have fled their homes. And the United Nations calls this the world's largest humanitarian crisis. It is bad. It is really, really bad. And I mean, so this, the reason why we're talking about this is because now there are the news that the Rapid Support Forces have kind of captured a town of around 400, well, not a town, a city of 400,000 people. And there are big concerns going on about what are they going to do to these people. And there's already some concerning reports coming out, right? And again, 10 years ago, this would be all over the news. And there would be emergency summons, there would be phone calls, and there would be a lot of like diplomatic efforts, particularly by the West, to stop this, right? To intervene, to do anything. And again, right? I mean, particularly last 10 years, we've moved away from intervening militarily, but doing something. And these efforts, I mean, I don't know if we were the ones who killed them, right? By saying that, oh, the responsibility to protect is a really difficult concept and it's part of the Western bubble. But there's none of this talk at the moment.
No, and there are so many different aspects to it. The first is just that there's too much happening for people, right? The news cycle is at its limit. People are specifically concerned about things at home. If you're an American citizen, your attention more than usual is going just to what is happening with your own country. For Europeans, in many ways, the same. So there is a limit in how much information can we absorb. And in those situations, then our attention, when we don't feel comfortable about our own lives, goes to ourselves, and we cannot or we choose not to pay attention to people who are very far away, at least in our minds. You know, Sudan is not that far away from Europe, but it feels far away emotionally. We don't really know much about the country. It's not part of our historical culture. And then it's very easy to dismiss. And this is the sign of Western societies who are no longer comfortable, right? If you are comfortable in your own life, you can start caring about others. But if you're stressed about your own life, if you're stressed about your future, your children's future, then others become all of a sudden less relevant. That is one of the aspects here. The other thing is, well, you mentioned R2P, and we've talked about that in the past. The responsibility to protect in many ways was kind of a bad outcome of the liberal world order, because it was like a Trojan horse. How can the West go in to societies and basically decide who is right and who is wrong? I've always been extremely critical of it. However, it was based on a society, a global society, a Western society, where we at least nominally cared about human well-being around the world, right? Because we need, basically, leadership said, hey, we want to be able to go into certain societies for geopolitical reasons. How can we do that? Well, we can use the excuse of saying, human disasters, genocide, famine, whatever, allow us to basically take action. So it was based on this world where morality still mattered. Now, global leadership is not busy with keeping the world together. It's not busy with saving lives. It's not interested in human well-being. And it's interesting what you're saying, this, you know, almost like cry for help, like, hey, how come that after criticizing all the Western bubble aspects, now I'm kind of wishing back to those good old days of responsibility to protect, you know, it sounds so much better than what we've got now. It reminds me a little bit of voters these days. So people are very upset by the establishment, like we were upset by the Western bubble. People are upset by the direction of their societies. But it doesn't mean that any alternative to what there is good, right? And that's where people go wrong. So you, as an Argentinian, I don't know what it feels like to be an Argentinian and looking back at the past 40 years. It must be horrific because your country has gone through significant, significant downturn, economically, socially, whatever. All of that must be terrible. But that doesn't mean that Milei is the answer. You know, the fact that everything was bad doesn't mean that you can just make things worse by choosing someone like Milei. The same for the Netherlands. I think the Netherlands have less to complain about than Argentina. The Dutch are, you know, in a much more comfortable spot. But there are things that they're upset about. That doesn't mean that Wilders or those extreme right-wing populists are the answer. They will break it even more. And that's what we're seeing right now. The fact that the Western bubble had such significant problems, that there was such Western delusion, by the way, which also relates to Sudan and the history of Sudan. The West has a lot of responsibility going back all the way to the British Empire and even before when it comes to Sudan. Putting Sudan on the rogue nation list together with Iran and North Korea, isolating it, basically letting the then dictator Bashir do whatever he wanted in the country. And only later issuing an ICC warrant that doesn't make any sense. All of that is from a time period, is from a world where the West was flawed, the West was mistaken, but at least they could still claim some kind of moral vision, however flawed it was. And now, in today's world, there is just no longer any moral vision. And people say, oh, problems in Sudan? Well, it's not my problem. We've got things at home. And it is the very definition of the end of a world order. There is no longer any driver behind geopolitical empathy, geopolitical solidarity, any kind of idea of we as a globe with over 8 billion people need to get along and need to make something out of our future. It is a dog-eat-dog world where people are defending their own islands, and that's about it.
What I'm concerned about is that, as of now, we're only talking about one dog who is a bit rogue, but it's kind of the dog that kept everything else in check. I'm worried for the next few years when more countries realize they can behave like this without any serious consequences, right? So what happens if There's other countries that start blowing up boats for whatever reason, right? And I mean, we're already kind of seeing it because, and this is like a micro topic I wanna insert for the last few minutes. We're seeing more and more military coups all over the world, right? Where military juntas suddenly take over countries. Something that we haven't seen at this at least, well, I mean, this intensity in a long time, because again, there's no global order where you have like a group of countries at least looking over and saying, hey, maybe don't do that, right? Let's back the civilian government, whether that was good or bad. But that's right, and so I'm worried that these military juntas are now going to take over. That you have a bunch of men who are very comfortable with power and who want to use that power, similarly to the way that this other loose dog that we've been talking about for the last 40 minutes now is doing.
Yeah, in the past, as in 20 years ago or so, you paid a price for being a military junta. Being a military junta was costly. It was difficult because you would be ousted from international dynamics. The UN wouldn't like you. International organizations wouldn't like you. The West would often boycott you. Others didn't want to be associated with you. You'd pay a price. Now, the military juntas of let's start the list of Burkina Faso, of Mali, of Niger, Madagascar. There is no price that they're actually paying for it. Nobody's boycotting them. Nobody's saying I don't want to work. In fact, the West is horrified by how much influence Russia has in Western Africa and are not trying to do business with them because trying to say, hey, can we still be friends? So again, the perfect sign of a lack of world order. It's just people trying to get their own profits out of certain situations to gain out of the suffering of others. And there is no sense of broad human well-being. If the UN was supposed to do anything, it was supposed to tell people we're all in this together, right? And that idea is completely gone. What do you care about people dying because of a dictatorship somewhere else? You have to defend your own little island. When it comes to other countries basically emulating or imitating the United States, I mean, of course, it's a very significant threat. Not just at a relatively small level, like a country like Burkina Faso. I mean, all due respect to Burkina Faso, but we're not talking about a geopolitical powerhouse. Of course, it makes it easier for countries like Russia, India, China, and also me, Turkey, and potentially even, like Indonesia, all those kinds of countries to, in the long run, start this behavior, and no one will tell them anything about it. No one will tell them off. What I find fascinating, maybe this is going to change in the next 5 or 10 years because of what we just discussed with respect to China, but that Beijing is still relatively well behaved. Despite the Western bubble mentality that China is the threat to the world, China actually doesn't do that much of this stuff. In the way that the United States is doing it. They might now see a door open and start doing it, but they still seem to feel that they are the reasonable ones, and they are kind of in a way doing what I would like Europe to do.
Yeah, I mean that's so. I was just gonna say that. I mean, China is basically following your advice, telling everyone like going basically up against the United States while telling everyone who's affected by the tariffs, don't worry, we'll do business with you. And I mean, I do see a world in which China would be unhappy about. Particularly right about like this anarchy of tariffs and also the seas no longer being safe to sail because of whatever actions of whatever rogue actor, simply because China has a very right, like simply has the economic interest in keeping the world more or less stable. I mean, every country has that interest, right? But particularly countries that have built their standing in the world on that economic might.
Absolutely, and it is to their credit that China still has some kind of vision, even though I don't think it's the strong vision of 10 years ago anymore. But they still have some kind of world that they would like to see grow, and I think the question that, well, certainly Americans, but for them they first have to stabilize the domestic situation, but that Europeans and other victims, previous victims of the Western bubble, have to ask themselves, who are we? Where are we going? What are we going to be? And what is our relationship with the rest of the world? Whether they'll be able to do that, that's another question, because it seems that current leadership is not up to the task.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard us make a mistake throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com. We will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That's it from my side, Balder. Which closing quote did you pick for us today?
This is a quote from the great oracle of Western delusion in the 1990s, Francis Fukuyama, who obviously very much believed the 21st century was going to be the triumph of the neoliberal world order. But he was very intelligent in understanding certain underlying dynamics. And one of the things that is being under-highlighted in today's world, based on the collapse of the neoliberal world order, is that that will also lead to the collapse of foundational capitalism as we know it. People seem to think that, oh yeah, well, anarchy and capitalism go together. No. Capitalism requires structure, requires order. Otherwise, it eats itself up. And this is something that's not being discussed a lot, and maybe in the future we can, but Fukuyama, despite his delusion with respect to Western supremacy, did very much recognize this, and he wrote specifically, "For capitalism flourishes best in a mobile and egalitarian society."